Okay, great to be back with you for another GoldSeek.com Radio Gold Nugget. Today's featured guest, Michael Pinto of Pinto Portfolio Strategies. It's just great to welcome back Michael Pinto from Pinto Portfolio Strategies to the show, president and founder of the firm. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on the program, Chris.
Yeah, great to have you back. A topic I've seen in a lot of your interviews lately, risk in 2019 of a global slowdown, and that could have big implications for markets that have really priced in perfection.
Okay, so Chris, the slowdown is already here. The slowdown in 2019 for Wall Street is a low probability. But if you look at what's happening right now in October of 2018, the slowdown is here. If you look at the chaos in emerging markets, you have a slowdown in Turkey and in Argentina and in Brazil and in Europe. And it all stems from the slowdown that's happening right now in China. And I can go on and on. I can name about 19, 20 countries off the top of my head that they are in some stage of a currency crisis, an equity market debacle.
Peripheral nations, we're seeing this. What's going to bring it home to us, though?
We already see that the cost of lumber price, the lumber prices have tumbled about 20% so far, actually about 40% so far this year. Copper is in a bear market. Let me just name about 5 or 10 things off the top of my head that's going to bring the chaos in emerging markets home to the United States. So first of all, we know that the Fed has raised rates again for the 8th time since it began this tightening cycle. They're going to raise rates one more time in 2018 in December. And that is most likely going to invert the yield curve. So I know people are going to say, well, you know, look around the world at all that chaos. Look at China. Look what's going on in South America. Look what's going around in Europe. And you say, well, that's their problem. That's not the problem of the United States. But how is it possible that we can invert the yield curve in December of 2018 and not have a recession here in the United States? The last 9 out of the last 10 times the yield curve has inverted since in the 1950s, we have had a recession. Not only this, but the Fed, in my opinion, is probably one of the most hawkish Federal Reserves we have ever had. If you add the 8 rate hikes we've already had 4 times per year, that's the current pace. They're supposed to go 3 more times in 2019. When you add to those rate hiking cycles, 25 basis points at each meeting, when you add to that quantitative tightening, which this very month increased to $50 billion worth of bond sales. So we're selling the Fed's balance sheet down at the pace of $600 billion a year, plus 4 rate hikes. Now, I think every time the Fed, every month, when they drain $50 billion worth of liquidity from the system, that's the equivalent of another rate hike. Very, very hawkish Federal Reserve.
Yes, we're watching the balance sheet at the St. Louis Fed. It's a 5% decline roughly from the ultimate peak. However, the recent guidance at last week's FOMC meeting, it sounds a little more dovish, at least on paper.
The Fed said that they are going to raise rates to around 3%. Look at their dot plot. They're going to take the Fed funds rate to 3%. It's only 2.25% right now, 2 to 2.25%. And they said they're going to be above, they want to be above that so-called R star, which is the neutral real rate of a Fed funds policy. It's a fantasy that this rate even exists, Chris. It's only in the minds of a central banker that they can pin a real Fed funds rate that's neither stimulative to inflation but reaches maximum employment. There are stars around 3%. They said in their last meeting that they want to be over R star for 2 years. So let's just say they go to 3.4 or 3.5% on the Fed funds rate and they want to leave it there for 2 years. Now that I think is very restrictive at the same time that they are draining $600 billion worth of bonds from the banking system. They're taking these excess reserves and they're burning them. So you add those two things together and you say, you have to ask yourself, Chris, who is going to support our $1 trillion per annum deficits that are already here?
You know, the typical money manager, they didn't sit through the 2000 crash. Some of them, not even the 2008. And they're thinking to themselves, when I translate this Fed speak, that sounds like a red hot economy. The Fed slamming the brakes on this thing.
So that's what they did in the year two, leading up to the year 2000. They were slamming on the brakes. If you remember that the Fed had the Fed funds rate at 1% between 2003 and 2004. Then they raised rates 0.25% at each and every meeting till they reached 5.25% in 2005. And they did so, you know, the Fed wasn't saying, I think there's a housing bubble and I am going to try to pop it. And the Fed wasn't saying that the economy is slowing down and I don't care. I'm going to still jam on the brake pedal, cause the entire global financial market to melt down. They weren't saying that. They were saying, let's gradually pop a housing bubble and let the air out very gently on the seams, on the margin. And then the economy will just slow down, and who cares if the subprime mortgage market blows up, because it's a very small part of housing, and new home construction is a very small part of the global economy. That's exactly, in the U.S. economy, that's exactly what they were saying in 2005 and 2006, and even 2007, until we had those Bear Stearns hedge funds blow up, and they were kind of tiptoeing around the edges even when Lehman blew up. In 2008, 10-year anniversary was last month. So the central bankers aren't proactive in nature. They're not oracles. They don't foresee what's coming. But if you look at markets, markets are telling you, and they were telling you in 2006 and 2007, if you look at high yield LIBOR spreads, if you look at what's going on in the banking system, if you were looking about what's going on, even the stock market. The stock market was started to roll over in the summer of 2007. So I look at markets. I run money for a living. So I have 20 economic and inflation indicators. So I have an inflation, deflation, and economic cycle model that I monitor and look at for when it's time for me to go net short the market. And believe me when I tell you that I'm not going to get short too early on a net short basis. But when my model tells me it's time to short this market, you have a chance to make a tremendous amount of money, because the value of assets in relation to the underlying economy has never been greater. So the value of assets, if you look at the market cap of equities, they are 150% of the underlying economy. And I can name you a plethora of other metrics: market price to sales, market price to book value. So all these values are at record highs. Median PE ratios, record highs. And they are signaling to me that this market is extremely overvalued. It's become completely reliant on central bank quantitative easing on a global basis, which, by the way, happens to end in December of this year. They're going to go from a 2017 that reached its peak at $180 billion worth of QE per month, and that goes to zero by the end of this year.
Obviously, the Fed is turning around. They're not just tightening. They're going negative. This is negative territory for the first time since 2008, 2009, the Great Recession. It's a big sea change event here we're looking at financially. And another interesting point you make here in your research is that China, well, not quite twice, our national debt.
Well, they went from $1 trillion in debt, the equivalent of $1 trillion of debt just prior to the year 2000, to $30 trillion. This is not national debt. This is a total debt. So total debt in the United States is $65 trillion. So, you know, we still have a lot more debt here in the United States. Chinese government, when they have a command and control economy, they started to accumulate debt in the year 2000 after the recession that we had here in the United States. And then in the wake of the financial crisis circa 2008, they started really expeditiously piling on debt. Now they have $30 trillion worth of debt. And when you increase debt from $1 trillion to $30 trillion in the span of 20 years, I can assure you that this is the most unstable pile of debt that the world has ever seen. And it wasn't debt that was taken on through normal channels. In other words, it wasn't a surplus of savings that fostered low interest rates that encouraged the public sector to borrow debt. This is all government-infused command and control debt. And that is why it's completely unstable, completely unproductive, and that is one of the main reasons, not just tariffs, that is one of the main reasons why you see so much chaos in emerging markets. It's because of this trenchant and watershed slowdown in Chinese GDP growth.
Okay, but if we look at your peak liquidity chart, I mean, clearly liquidity did peak, you know, somewhere around March of 2017, and we've had at least initially a slow decline in overall liquidity worldwide, and now it's accelerating. But the U.S. is not reflecting that. Is part of that due to the fact that funds have been flowing in here seeking higher returns and the relative return they can receive on the U.S. dollar?
Well, you're exactly correct. So if you have quantitative easing, quantitative easing here ended in 2015, but then started right back up, 2014, excuse me, and then started right back up in China and the Bank of England and in the ECB and most definitely in the Bank of Japan. The QE ending in the United States was almost immediately supplanted by overseas markets. But that's all coming to an end here. You know, just this month, the Fed went to $50 billion per month from $40 billion a month in reverse QE. But also, the European Central Bank cut their quantitative easing program from 30 billion euros to 15 billion euros in October. And they will be completely out of QE come December. So on a net basis, the globe will be shrinking its balance sheet. That's the first time that has ever happened. But let me give you something this is why it's so crucial that I put that in the research. Why is quantitative easing so important, Chris, that we went from $180 billion a month just last year on top of tax reform and repatriation? Why is it so important that this year it goes to zero? So let's take a look at the Fed's balance sheet. Since 2008, the Fed's balance sheet increased by $3.7 trillion. It went up to $4.5 trillion. It's since backed off because of quantitative tightening to $4.2 trillion. Okay, so we have a much bigger Fed balance sheet, an increase of $3.7 trillion at its peak. But publicly traded debt in the United States has skyrocketed to $11 trillion, skyrocketed by $11 trillion to over $15 trillion. So you have this increase of the Fed's balance sheet, which went to 3.7, and now it's just 3.4, trying to support $11 trillion worth of additional publicly traded debt. That is why it's so crucial that when you have a $1 trillion deficit and interest rates on the debt is soaring, you know, by the way, the deficits in the United States are up 33% year on year. Where is the money going to come from to support these debt and deficits? It has to come from the private sector, and that's money that's being taken away from capital goods creation. And that means the economy is going to slow even faster than normal.
Okay, now let me play the advocate here for Martin Armstrong, one of our guests from last week on the show. He has been one of the permabulls on our show, and he's been right for a decade. Louis Navalier, another. All your facts are correct. However, it hasn't mattered up until this point. Where's the tipping point here? Because I'm looking at your charts, it's very compelling. But again, you know, the road is strewn with the carcasses of the bears for a decade.
Okay, well, first of all, I manage money. Said I have a model. It's a 20-point model that measures and maps the growth and inflation dynamic. So right now, the portfolio is not net short, and it hasn't been since the inception of my firm. The process that I'm looking at, one of the things that I mentioned to you before, was let's look at what's new. What do I see happening in 2019? I will tell you as I sit here talking to you, in October of 2018, that I think the portfolio is going to go net short sometime between now and the end of the year for the first time in order to capitalize from this toboggan ride that I see in stock prices. But why have I waited so long, and what's going to be different? So like I said, the Fed is probably going to invert the yield curve for the first time since 2006. Now, that has never happened between 2006 and till this interview. So it hasn't yet happened during that big bull market that you're referring to, but it's about to happen. The spread is now 25 basis points between the 10-year note and the 2-year note. One or two more rate hikes should be enough to completely invert the yield curve, and that usually, in the past, 90% of the time, precipitates a downturn in the stock market and then a recession about 6 months to a year and a half later. Look look at what's going on in 2017 compared to, and 2018 compared to what's going to happen in 2019. Okay, the earnings per share next year. So right now we have about 25% year-over-year earnings growth. It's going to plummet down to the low single digits at best. And that's due to the spike in interest rates across the globe. You know, I told you, you know, on the show already that global central banks were printing $180 billion per month of QE in aggregate. But 14 out of the 20 biggest central banks in the world are in the process of raising rates right now. That's new. So we've went from a very dovish monetary policy regime to one that's concurrently hawkish across the globe. Look at peak margins, oil prices that are rising, wages that are rising, tariffs, the chaos in emerging markets, the slowdown in China, corporate buybacks, which were from the Repatriation Act of foreign earnings in the tax cut package, that goes away. These are all things that are going to go away in 2019.
In the year 2000, it was the tech wreck that essentially pricked the bubble. And then 2007, 2008, it was financial / subprime debacle. What are we looking at this? What's the Lehman? What's the Bear Stearns here?
Besides the fact, we are in the biggest sovereign debt bubble in the history of planet Earth. So here's my evidence. Why in the world would any individual entity other than the Bank of Japan buy a Japanese government bond that's duration is 10 years and get 0.10% interest rate per year when they have an inflation target that's 2% and it's a country that has a 250% debt to GDP? Japan shows you that we are in an unprecedented sovereign debt bubble where some $8 trillion worth of sovereign debt. So the question is, you have to ask yourself is, what's going to happen to that bubble? And as interest rates surge, by definition, if a bubble bursts in the sovereign debt market, sovereign bond prices will plunge and those interest rates will rise. If that happens, and it happens on top of an economy that is taken on a global basis, an additional $70 trillion in new debt since 2007, that's a 40% increase. So we now have $250 trillion of global debt, up 40%, up $70 trillion. So much for that deleveraging that everybody likes to talk about. Even as a percentage of the phony economy, which was bolstered by these low rates, negative rates, it's now 320% of GDP, global GDP, up from 270% in 2008. Okay, so when you have $70 trillion worth of new debt piled onto an economy that couldn't handle that debt in 2008, when you have a bursting of the sovereign debt bubble, which has already begun. If you look at the United States, if you look at LIBOR, the London Interbank Offered Rate, that was 0.3% in 2006. It's now 2.4%. It's a huge increase in LIBOR, which is tied to $370 trillion in derivatives and loans. If you look at the 10-year note, it was 1.3%, and now it's 3.1% on the U.S. 10-year note. So you have the bubble in sovereign debt already bursting. I just laid out to you how deficits are exploding in the United States without any help from quantitative easing. So as central banks pull back, you're having this explosion in debt, in particular in LIBOR, which is the interest rate that you should be watching if you're looking at the cost of credit cards, any kind of floating rate debt, housing loan, floating rate mortgage loans. So the sovereign debt bubble is exploding on top of the additional $70 trillion in debt. And if you think that's a great environment to buy stocks that are at a record bubble price, then go ahead and do it. I know you're taking the other side. I'm not taking this, not personal, but I am not going to, in an unhedged portfolio, go levered long Amazon and FANG stocks in that environment. It's an extremely dangerous perilous environment. You're fighting global central banks, and it's not going to end well.
Okay, so then once we see the end of this, see another 2008-style pullback in U.S. equities, those funds are going to flow somewhere. They're not going to be terribly intrigued by the bond market or the debt market. Commodities look like a possible go-to place.
Yes, absolutely. And cash are going to be king, in my opinion. Once we have this another iteration, the next iteration of a global bond crisis. And in particular, precious metals, you know, I like commodities in general during inflation times, but more specifically, I do like gold in the next environment. Gold is set up perfectly if you look at the record shorts on the CFTC. If you look at the universal pessimism, not true. I think gold stands to be in a position to skyrocket in the wake of the next economic crisis.
Okay, so we've heard this, though, for a few years. What's your target on the yellow metal? Let's say after a U.S. equities rollover.
First of all, I have virtually no position now in the gold market, thankfully. My portfolio has had been short emerging markets and long the U.S. dollar. I have virtually no position in gold as we speak, about a 2% position in the portfolio in a gold-related investment. The reason why I have not been long gold is because my model, which I built, took decades for me to build this model, told me very clearly that a rising dollar and a rising real interest rate environment is not good for gold. However, I don't think we're very far away from starting to see some very negative news on the economic data front here in the United States. And when that happens, I think the U.S. dollar begins to roll over, even against the euro and the yen, possibly on the margins. But most importantly, and here's the key, Chris, I think in the next two quarters, so by the end of Q1 2019, the central bank of the United States will move from a very hawkish monetary policy stance to one that is neutral, and then quickly followed on the heels of that to a dovish policy. And then at that time, I think gold begins to rip higher and quickly ascends within 12 months to an all-time nominal high above 1900 and even 2000.
You know, obviously we've got an unbelievable gold to silver ratio. Will we start to see that reverse, you know, because we might lose some of that industrial demand for AG?
You'll lose a lot of industrial demand for AG, not so much in AU. So I don't expect that ratio to close. No, I'm much more bullish on gold.
Okay, but let's talk about shares, because a lot of our listeners are big fans of the XEU and HUI. Clearly, we've been in the doldrums.
Well, doldrums would be the polite way of putting it. I think that to get leverage on the yellow metal, to get leverage on AU, you need to seek the miner. So in a bear market, gold miners get killed, and in a bull market, gold miners soar hundreds of percentage points. So my intention is to increase the exposure in gold in the portfolio, in physical gold, but to even a greater extent, purchase more of the miners to get that leverage of the gold in the ground once we enter a bull market. And my best guess at this juncture is sometime around Q1 2000.
I'd like to move on to the Case-Shiller Housing Index. We've just seen, especially when you look at it city by city, unbelievable explosion, called an echo bubble, exceeding the former peak in most of the major U.S. cities, Canada doing well.
So the nucleus of the bubble in 2008, the Great Recession, was the housing market. And that is not the nucleus of the bubble today. So if you look at the peak of home prices in 2006, they were 5.3 to 1 on the home price to income ratio, which is one of the main reasons why I was warning about a housing bubble, started warning about one in late 2005. I said, watch this home price to income ratio. It's usually 3. It skyrocketed all the way to 5.3, and I knew that was, you know, unsustainable. And you look at the quality of the loans and all that stuff. On top of it, we are now at 4.7 on a home price to income ratio. So not where we were in 2005, 2006 at the peak, but pretty darn close. But again, that is not the nucleus of the bubble, although there is an echo bubble in the housing market. The nucleus of this bubble is sovereign debt and all fixed income. And in particular, I want to point you to corporate debt. So corporate debt is at an all-time nominal high. Corporate debt has doubled in the United States since 2008. And not only that, corporate debt as a percentage of GDP is at its all-time record high, a little bit above 45% of the underlying economy. On top of all of that, the quality of the corporate debt is the lowest in history. In fact, about two-thirds of it is either junk or one notch above junk. And when you add to that leverage loans, which are placed in collateralized loan obligations, which are owned by the shadow banking system in a big way, this is the bubble. So it's going to be junk bonds and leverage loans and CLOs. That'll be the first thing to start to blow. I think that happens in the next quarter or so. And that'll be the time that you want to go net short in the portfolio and start going longer of gold.
You know, you've teased us a bit with your econometric model. You have a multivariate model you've put together with, you know, interest rates, a lot of macro and some micro variables. Can you give those of us with a statistical background or penchant an idea of what you have without giving away too much proprietary?
Well, like I said, it's a 20-point model. There's 10 components of the model that are geared towards divining where we are on the inflation front, and 10 components on the economic cycle model, see if we're growing or if we're slowing. It's a rate of change diffusion index that spits out a number that lets me know where we are on the inflation deflation cycle and growth cycle. The model sits today, we're at sector 2, which is a pension towards deflation, a proclivity towards deflation. I think we head to sector 1, which is a 2008 sort of deflation where you see the U.S. dollar spiking and when it's a good time to short the broader market. So it's a diffusion index, 20 components. I look at things like high yield spreads, LIBOR spreads, real interest rates from the Federal Reserve, pending home sales, auto sales. I don't want to give away the whole model, but there's 20 components very rigorously back-tested. If you want to really protect your investments from the coming decline and to know where to invest, where you're going to get the best return, the safest return, in my opinion, you have to know where the economy is on that spectrum between inflation, deflation, and growth. And if you know that, I think your investments will be treated most prudently.
One slight proviso or caveat. I'm sure you're also somewhat of a fan, or at least acquainted with much of Nassim Taleb's work. And if you read, you know, through his Fooled by Randomness and all his latest stuff, I mean, the one thing he just pounds the table on, beware of these econometric models, because he says you get beyond one variable. Once you pass that threshold, forecasting ability over time, back tested, sure, it's great. Forward tested, it looks good. But in reality, it can blow up.
What model that you can point to has rigorously been tested against quantitative tightening? There is none, because nobody really knows. Certainly nobody at the Federal Reserve. No economic geek out there, no mathematician, and not even a philosopher can tell you exactly what's going to occur when the Federal Reserve takes money from the banking system and destroys it to the tune of $50 billion a month. So the banks were holders of assets. Those assets were taken from them, purchased from them by the Federal Reserve, and the banks held on to something known as excess reserves parked at the Federal Reserve. But those excess reserves were generating interest, and they actually held on to assets that were formerly owned by the banking system that were under distress. But as you start draining $600 billion worth of treasuries from the system, those treasuries, the Federal Reserve owns a treasury. That treasury was purchased from the banking system, from the primary dealers. Now the Federal Reserve says to the Treasury, I have $600 billion worth. It's not $600 billion. It's less than that because there's mortgage-backed securities in there too. But I have $400 billion worth of treasuries in 2019, fiscal 19. which started October. I have $400 billion worth of treasuries that I am not going to roll over. So the Treasury has to pay the Federal Reserve. But the Treasury has no money. So the Treasury now, instead of selling bonds to the Fed, now has to sell bonds to the public. And that raises interest rates. That raises the cost of borrowing, curtails corporations from borrowing money to buy back their shares. It drains the public sector of capital that can be allocated more efficiently. So bond yields are going to spike. That's on top of the $1 trillion-plus deficits that are already built in due to demographics and the interest on the debt. And God forbid we have a recession, which I predict, where interest rates are going to spike and deficits go up by $1.4 trillion in addition to the over $1 trillion that they're already reporting. So that's the process. So whereas before banks were selling bonds to the Federal Reserve and going out and buying more because they had the reserves, it wasn't going into inflation. It was going into asset prices. That's all going into reverse. So if the argument from Mr. Armstrong is that QE wasn't beneficial for stock prices and bond prices, it's ridiculous. Because I just proved that there's $11 trillion, or at the peak was $11 trillion, or maybe even more. Now it's about $8 trillion of negative yielding debt. Are we saying that the public wants to give money to a sovereign nation and get no interest and actually pay to loan money to the government? No. It's all about central bankers, and that's going into reverse, and that's why I believe and predict we're headed for a deflationary recession/depression in 2000.
Okay, yeah, you make a good point there, but what do you say, though, quickly to the folks on the other side of the spectrum who are convinced that it had little to do with QE operations, big growth here in U.S. equities, the buyback scenario, that it was record buybacks that really encouraged the U.S. equities investors to jump on that train, and it's been a self-fulfilling prophecy. Go ahead.
It's all part of it, Chris. So corporations took out a record amount of debt.
They distributed their bonds and they bought their shares with it.
Why they were able to buy back their shares? Because the cost of capital was virtually zero. It was very low. But that's not the case anymore. So the cost of capital is surging and has already surged and will continue to surge. At the same time, the Repatriation Act was a one-time shell game where you repatriated foreign earnings, pretty much a one-time event, where you're repatriating foreign earnings and you're buying back shares and issuing dividends. That's all a function of 2018. That's not new in 2019. There is no extra $500 billion coming back into the United States. You have a free trial for the podcast, and then it's a $49.99 per year podcast, which gives all the data that you won't see anywhere else, the analysis you don't get anywhere else. And if you have at least $100,000, I'll actually manage money for you according to that inflation, deflation, and growth model, where you can hopefully preserve your principal, make a little money while you're waiting for the indication to go net short the portfolio. And then I think shorting high yield, shorting the Russell 2000 is going to be a lot of fun.
You're not fully invested, just 2%. You're going to stick with your quarter 1 2019 thesis that we could see a good buying opportunity in just maybe 6 months or less?
My theory right now, according to the data, is that that's the time frame where we're going to see a change in the economic data. But if the economic data changes, like we have a non-farm payroll report, and if that shows that, I don't think it will, but if there was negative job growth, average hourly earnings fell, then I would adjust my portfolio accordingly. But as the data weakens, and I predict that that's coming, that type of data is coming, ISM data, that's part of the model. So as the data weakens is when I'll start scaling into gold.
Let's talk again after the FOMC meeting scheduled for December. We're going to have that rate hike there. It's virtually baked into the market cake already. I'd like to see if your prediction that we might just see an inversion. We have the flattening, but an inversion of the yield curve, because that doesn't bode well for U.S. shares 2019. Thank you, Michael Pinto.
Thank you, Chris.